expansion of settlements must continue. No peace negotiations can continue under those conditions.
Well, Noam, we want to thank you very much for being with us, spending the hour with us. Noam Chomsky, world-renowned political dissident, linguist and author, Institute professor emeritus at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he's taught for more than half a century and has written more than 100 books. We will link to our past interviews with him at our website, democracynow.org. You can also go to our website to see a number of new interviews about the U.S.-backed coup in Chile that took place 40 years ago today, September 11, 1973. I just spoke with the judges who later arrested and indicted General Augusto Pinochet, and with the forensic specialist who exhumed the bodies of ousted President Salvador Allende and singer Victor Jara. Also on our website, you can see our interactive timeline of the voices of dissent surrounding the September 11, 2001 attack. Here at home, we showcase our archive of in-depth reports documenting the attacks and their aftermath. Also, we have a job opening hiring a Linux systems administrator. Go to our website at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermin Sheikh.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is Wednesday Morning Talk Radio with host Lisa Loving. Today's guests are Blaise Bonpain, former priest and director of the Office of the Americas, and John Quigley, a professor of international law. We'll talk about the dual anniversaries of 9/11, the U.S.-backed coup in Chile, and the destruction of the World Trade Center in New York, and how these events relate to today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
KBOO Radio, in association with Radio Lost and Found and the Media Net Web, present a film this coming Thursday, September 12th, at Portland's historical Clinton Street Theater. This month, we feature a film titled Sonic Outlaws, about the Bay Area recording and performance group Negative Lands.
Yeah, we broke the law right now at this very instant, didn't we?
And their controversial album, U2.
He was a little dog named Snuggle.
Thursday, September 12th. For more information, go to kboo.fm on the right-hand side of our homepage under Community Events.
When the farmer comes to town with his wagon broken down, the farmer is...
Tune in to The Dirtbag every second Wednesday of the month at 11 a.m.
Learn to grow your tasty fruits and vegetables in your home garden.
There is a monthly garden stumper, calendar of gardening events. You can even call in with your gardening questions.
That's The Dirtbag every second Wednesday, 11 to 12 a.m. That's on KBOO
Portland.
Listen, laugh, learn.
The farmer is the man that feeds them all.
We'll be right back. It is 8:05 a.m. and you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Lisa Loving, and today, the anniversary of 9/11. From the World Trade Center to the U.S.-backed coup in Chile, we're live on the phone right now with liberation theology champion Blaise Bonpain. Mr. Bonpain, are you there?
Yes. Good morning, Lisa.
It's such an honor to have you on the air. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Mr. Bonpain, your life as an activist, a peace activist, a justice activist has stretched out through a couple generations, I'll say, a couple generations. Talk a little bit about the work you're doing now with the Office of the Americas, the organization that you created.
We had earlier focused on Latin America, but as of 1990, late in 1990, we heard of things happening in Iraq. So early 91, we went over to Baghdad to try to see what was happening, and we were there in January, just before the blitzkrieg of the elder Bush, and he came in with 88,000 tons of bombs at that time. And since that time, we've been very much focused on the Middle East because of the disaster after disaster and unnecessary war after unnecessary war. I mean, that was 91. that's a generation in itself that these wars have been going on. They went on through the Clinton administration as well. Many people lost their lives in that period because of sanctions, and they've continued to the present, and now there's this grave threat on Syria. So that's taken up much of our time in recent years.
Talk a little bit about Syria. That's what everyone's got our eyes on this morning, sir. Do you think we're going to bomb Syria?
Well, I would hope not. We were in the streets last week with the Syrian community, and basically the message we got was don't kill children because someone has killed children. So we don't solve the problem by making it worse. That should be, as our founder said, self-evident. But it's not self-evident. And this craving for war at this time on the part of the administration is certainly not on the part of our people, who are exhausted with wars, one after another, almost perpetual. So we don't see a need for that. We know that conferences are possible. We know that the parties can be brought together. We have ignored for years the United Nations. We use it when it suits us, and we defy international law whenever it doesn't. There's been so much hypocrisy here because of our long use of chemical weapons, the destruction of Vietnam with Agent Orange, and the use of depleted uranium, and the use of white phosphorus, and the endless use of these evil things, including cluster bombs, which children are attracted to. So there's a level of hypocrisy that is very hard to deal with, and it's a type of religion which is known as American exceptionalism. It is a religious concept that somehow God is on our side and that our manifest destiny calls us to rule from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. That's a religious thought, and that's why we can say you cannot have chemical weapons, but we can. You cannot have nuclear weapons, but we can have more than the rest of the world put together. This is all off-base reasoning, and it's not going to stand. We have 4% of the world's people. We're not going to tell the other 96% what they're going to do. We're failing. We've had failure after failure. Failure in Korea, failure in Vietnam, failure in Central America, failure in the Middle East, failure in Iraq, which is at war today. Thousands of people being killed, failure in Afghanistan, one of the weakest countries in the world. Their tribal methodologies apparently are too strong for the most powerful country in the world.
Yeah. And listeners, I have to put this out to you. The phone lines are open, listeners. Are you having a vigil or event tonight? Anyone in Cascadia having a peace vigil or 9/11 observation commemoration event, give us a call and let us know what you're working on. We would love to hear from you. 503-231-8187. Peace vigils tonight. Mr. Bompain, okay, I'm really old. I actually took a trip to the Salvadoran Civil War in the 1980s. And I feel as though, in terms of a peace movement or just community activism in the United States, I feel as though something has happened where people that I know that are everyday people, peace activists, we sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? We could not wrap our brains around literally the degree of evil and lying that was happening all around us. And as we're talking about 9/11, right? We talk weapons of mass destruction, right? Straight up lies, right? But I guess we shouldn't have been so surprised about that after Vietnam. But one of the things that I've not heard people talk that much about lately, and then we're also joined by John Quigley, but I wanted to ask you this really quickly, Mr. Bompain. One of the things that I don't hear people talk about now with this is the anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup in Chile. How about the assassination of Orlando Letelier and Ronnie Moffitt, linked to that, bombed in Washington, D.C.? I don't hear people talking about that. And Mr. Bompain, it's like sometimes I'm not sure if we're the peace movement, if we're ready to dig into, I mean, what I can only really describe as evil. I don't know the other word for that. Talk about that a little bit. I mean, talk about how would you apply liberation theology to what we're looking at today?
Well, if you look at the history, you can see that it was brought about by the effort to overthrow Salvador Allende, one of the great statesmen in the history of Latin America, who was the president in Chile, and that Henry Kissinger decided that we couldn't afford to have a socialist running a country in Latin America. And he, together with Mr. Nixon, planned this. And while Allende was in power, Mr. Nixon said, "Make the economy scream. We can destroy the economy of another country by various types of sanctions internationally." And so we were trying to do everything possible to ruin the presidency of Allende. And then when we failed, we supported the Nazi lodge of Chile. That's not an accusation. It's the Nazi lodge of Chile, and its member, Augusto Pinochet Ugarte, as president, and he came in with a fury. The only thing really similar to it today that's very important is Egypt. And if you read the Wall Street Journal regarding Egypt, you would read that we hope that President al-Sisi of Egypt will do the same things that Mr. Pinochet did in Chile. Here they are, the Wall Street Journal, praising Pinochet with the hope that Egypt may follow his fine example of killing thousands of people, torturing people. Mm. It is so tragic that our preferred method of government for other countries has been dictatorship.
Indeed.
Is not acceptable.
We're joined by Mr. John Quigley. John Quigley, professor of law at the Moritz College of Law at the Ohio State University. Mr. Quigley, thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Thank you.
Mr. Quigley, you've been really busy the past couple weeks since all the saber rattling around Syria. You have, and you published an essay yesterday that was about how the peace movement is changing in this more modern age. I wonder if you could talk about it a little bit.
Yes. What I said was that I thought that the peace movement now can draw on broader support from the public because of the experiences in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, that the public has really had enough of that, and that this really puts the peace movement, let's say, in a stronger position than it would have been, let's say, back at the time of the Vietnam War. And it seems to me that the peace movement is also getting a bit more, I don't want to say, well, smarter perhaps, that is focusing more on detail and challenging the statements of the administration. That is, and you know, you've just been mentioning the false information about Iraq in 2003, and now we see the peace movement focusing on that kind of analysis, whereas, you know, back 20 or 30 years ago, if we heard a Secretary of State saying something like what Mr. Kerry is saying about hair samples from the eastern suburbs of Damascus, we would automatically believe it. Now I think we're more skeptical. I mean, it may be true what he's saying, but then again, it may not be, and he isn't really putting forth in a public way the information on the basis of which one can decide whether it's valid or not, whether these hair samples were, you know, given by somebody in the opposition or, you know, there can be many reasons why that information could be invalid. And in the past, the information has very often been invalid. That is, more often than not, I would say, it has been invalid.
Amazing. Mr. Quigley, John B. Quigley, his essay, Seeking a New, More Nuanced Peace Movement, I caught it over on the CourierJournal.com, which is pretty fun. It's gone out on McClatchy Tribune News Service, so my mom could be reading this, which I think is pretty exciting. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. This is the anniversary of 9/11. We're looking at all the 9/11s and wondering how they're connected, and with an eye towards grabbing the handlebars of our bicycle and moving it towards solutions and what can we actually do. And do we have a caller? Actually, the Magical Engineering Pixie is on the phone right now. We had put out the call for people to call up with our peace event information, and there will be at least one peace vigil in Portland, Oregon tonight. Stand for Peace. It's at 6 p.m. on the Hawthorne Bridge, or any bridge, right? Bring signs or candles, and please respect traffic, pedestrians, and bikes so everyone stays safe, because they do not have a permit. That's tonight, Wednesday, September 11th, 6 p.m. until twilight. Hawthorne Bridge or any bridge, north or south side, east, west, or middle. Bring a candle or a sign. And we have Joanne on the phone. Joanne, what's going on?
First comment, hallelujah and blessed be for the event. Second, I guess I should call it. Someone was saying that war is exhausting people. Wars have destroyed me and my children and grandchildren's lives. I mean, all this horrible, big amounts of money, they don't put it into housing and food stamps and Medicare and health care and all that. It should be going in. And one last thing, even though there's a lot more, but I know you want other people to call in. I don't know whether this is local propaganda, but I'll put it out. You probably have to ignore it. But I heard cable is closing down. But anyway, bye.
Thanks for calling, Joanne, and anyone who, you know what, rumors of our demise are greatly exaggerated. Let's put it that way. By the way, KABU, our annual meeting, is coming up this weekend. Go on our website and check it out. If you think that KABU is closing down, come on down to, yes, and vote at our annual meeting. I'm personally going to bring cookies to that event. Let you know you should be there. And I do have gluten-free options. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. It's the anniversary of 9/11. We're live on the phone with Blaise Bond Payne and John Quigley, an incredible panel of experts there. And we're looking at how are these issues linked between, say, for example, the U.S.-backed coup in Chile on September 11th, 40 years ago, I believe. And this is the... Is it the 13th anniversary of 9/11? I need more coffee. Part of me doesn't want to face these issues, John and Blaise. I think that some of these, this is exactly why we have Honey Boo Boo trending on television, because people don't want to face the reality. And you know, first of all, actually, I wanted to go back to Mr. Quigley. One of the questions that we're looking at today is, are we going to bomb Syria? And Mr. Quigley, you participated in this completely fascinating online thing just a few days ago, I believe. It was an Syria Insta Symposium about intervention. And I wonder if you could talk about that a little bit, Mr. Quigley. Like, what are the actual rules of intervention? And how do we relate to those rules? Do they even matter? I mean, does our government actually really pay attention to what international law says?
Well, there is an international rule that goes back a long way that says that when there's a civil war going on in another country, outside states are supposed to stay out. They're not supposed to be involved one way or the other. And so what the United States is proposing to do is really in violation of that concept. There really are only two ways that a state can lawfully use military force. One is if it is being attacked, it has to defend itself, or to defend another country that is being attacked. And secondly, if the Security Council of the UN decides that there's a threat to the peace that needs to be dealt with by way of military force. So those are really the only two ways. And if you look at what's been said by the Secretary General of the United Nations over the last few days, Mr. Ban Ki-moon, he says that it would have to be done by the Security Council in Syria, if at all.
All right. And do we have a caller? Okay. So I kind of also want to go back to Joanne's point of how everyone in this country is impacted by the wars because of all the money we pour in there. And when we talk about 9/11, we talk about why did our government rush to attack, you know, after the bombing in the trade centers. Many of us in this, what we think of as a peace movement, we think of that as a problem. But for other people, say perhaps executives in the petrochemical industry, that's actually a solution, something that shores up their profits. And there is a conservative investigative reporting, citizen reporting blog called watchdog.org that we saw emerge here earlier this year. And their headline this week was, "Watch oil prices spike behind the saber rattling in Syria." And Mr. Bompain, I wonder if you would talk about that a little bit. I mean, do you have a sense about that? Who benefited in Latin America from the U.S. coup? I should say U.S. backed coup. And, you know, and who benefits now?
If you're talking about Chile, it was a matter of the nationalization of various firms, especially Kennecott and Braden Copper Companies, and the effort to nationalize, the response to that was to overthrow the government, and that's exactly what we did in the case of Mr. Mossadegh in 1953 in Iran. Every Iranian child knows that we overthrew their government and their favorite president ever, Mohammad Mossadegh. Oil has been the issue in so many areas, and of course in Latin America as well. Pemex nationalized the oil in Mexico in 1938 because there was a war coming on. We didn't intervene, but now we're still attempting to complete the privatization of oil, even in Mexico. And 9/11, of course, in the recent 9/11, was a vicious crime committed against the people of the United States. And as the whole world said at the time, they saw it as a crime, not as an attack by a nation. It wasn't an attack by a nation. It was an attack by a group of criminals, and the entire police forces of the world would have wanted to help us apprehend whatever criminals were living that might be responsible for that. So instead of doing what we should have done, which is to look at it as a terrible crime, we attacked one of the poorest countries in the world, which did not attack us. These criminals may have been hiding there, and they may not have been hiding there. It would be like destroying Chicago because some organized crime figures were there. So our behavior has become utterly unacceptable since the end of World War II. We have been at war continually, one after another, all of them unnecessary. And this is what our people have to understand, that it is not necessary to have these wars. And if we study history, as Howard Zinn would have had us study it, we would look at the Revolutionary War and say, you know, that war didn't have to happen, so our students should study how it could have been avoided. As we look at each war, we look at the Civil War. Did we have to have a Civil War? No, we did not. How could that war have been avoided? That's the way to study history, not to glorify these horrible wars, which were simply a mixture of murder and rape and theft. They're not okay. Instead of triumphalism, we need the realism of analysis and critical thought.
What is interesting to me about what's happening right now with Syria, and listeners, of course, the number to call is 503-231-8187, is that I work on a little newspaper, and I'm in the email flow of many conservative organizations, the Republican National Committee, as I said already, watchdog.org, and a few others. And I've seen more conservative people suddenly jump on the anti-war bandwagon. Like, I never knew that was possible, right? My lifetime. I turned 50 years old this year. I've never seen conservatives jump on a don't bomb it platform. I mean, and I'm wondering, Mr. Bob Payne and Mr. Quigley, what's happening with the peace movement now? Is that just the flippity-flop of politics, or do you see that more conservative people are literally saying the same thing that I heard liberal people say just some few years ago? You know, it's going to cost this much money, it's going to kill this many people. What is your take on that, Mr. Bob Payne and Mr. Quigley both? I'd love to hear from you both about that.
If you would look at the website Come Home America, you will find a coming together of left, right, Tea Party, up, down, backwards. What do we have one thing we can agree on, and the agreement is on no war, and that includes the libertarians. This coming together of people from different perspectives is how we're going to end this whole thing, because the Tea Party people realized that government expenditures in certain issues were costing a lot of money. Suddenly, they're beginning to understand that the expenses for what is called defense, which is really offense, are bankrupting the country. And if they can put aside the false patriotism of war making, they, as conservatives, will join in and say, you know, where your treasure is, there your heart will be. And our treasure has been in war making, and we have to put a stop to that.
Mr. Quigley, what do you think? Because you've been looking at this. I already said this earlier. You've been really busy the past couple of weeks. You put out a lot of incredible writing and analysis, amazing stuff. I really want to point people toward you. But what do you think about that? I don't think I've ever seen that in my lifetime, with conservatives and liberals joining together against bombing something.
Yeah, I think that's right, as Mr. Bob Payne is saying, that that it's really across the spectrum now, and I think it is in large part a reaction to what's gone on over the last decade or so, that it's now, you know, widely recognized that we went into Iraq on a basis that was not valid. And then we've seen the consequences. Now, with the increasing ability to provide medical care for people who are seriously wounded, we see these incredible numbers of people coming back from these wars, without limbs, with PTSD, and that's something that we really didn't have so much with previous wars. And we had as well for a period of time in Iraq and Afghanistan, people in the military reserves that were being sent over on successive stints in those countries, you know, disrupting the lives of many people across the board in the country. And so the impact of these wars has been felt, I think, in ways that weren't true previously.
You know, another thing that's different, and it really gets me too, and I wonder if it's really impacted people that are more on the conservative spectrum, is it's the military suicides, man. The military suicides, 8,000 military suicides in the past year. Here in Oregon, we just had the fourth suicide of Guards member, right? Oregon doesn't even have a military base. All we have is the National Guard. And the National Guard is like who protects you when aliens attack, right? And when that gigantic octopus came up out of the bay, it was the National Guard that helped people out. But in the absence of a war or something like that, we bundled up Oregon's National Guard and sent them to Afghanistan and specifically, and also a few times to Iraq. And The suicide thing, that part really does baffle me. And I am looking at this headline in the New York Times, baffling rise in suicides plagues the military. It's like, where do you think that's coming from, Mr. Quigley and Mr. Bompain? I feel like that's such an important issue. Can I just touch you guys on that? What do you think?
Well, I think war drives people insane because it is not a normal situation. And we see that in the terrible number of people injured, coming in a minimum of 300,000 with post-traumatic stress. There's a terrible influence of that on the rest of their lives, really in many cases destroying their families, which have already been broken up by virtue of them being overseas and then coming home very sick, sometimes abusive, sometimes dependent on drugs or alcohol. And this is a great tragedy of destruction of an enormous amount of our population, to say nothing of the devastation of the innocent people in these countries, the children primarily. We should realize that when we deal with these countries, we're dealing with places where children are the majority. And so we have had a long, vicious war on the children of the Middle East.
And that is actually, I have to say that the Democracy Now! Episode that was about they've had many episodes now about the chemical weapon attack in Syria, but they included one, I feel as though it was the week before this past week, where they just showed a film of the bodies, and it was unbelievable. And now that's not the same as the war in Afghanistan, but I think that is what we see, is that children are impacted everywhere. Mr. Quigley, I want to tap into your special knowledge a little bit, though. A generation ago or so, you wrote a book called The Ruses for War, and it was a real doorstopper. It's a big, great big book, and it's literally about what you sort of touched on a little earlier in this hour, like how The Ruses for War is like all the excuses that U.S. administrations have ever made. Can you talk about that book a little bit? What did you find in the research for that book, and has anything changed since you published it?
This actually feeds up what Mr. Bompain was saying about the wars that we've been involved in, the military incursions over the last half century or so, and whether or not there was any necessity for them. What I found in looking at military intervention by the United States since the Second World War was that the reasons given publicly for them almost never correlated with the real reasons for the incursion. That is, we almost always had some reason for going in that was not being disclosed, and so we made up something else. As the Pentagon, the administration made up something else and put it across to the public. And this is why I think if we can get all that under our belts, you know, we'll be much more skeptical when we hear information being put out as to the need for military action. I mean, one thing that's routinely been said in these situations is that not all the information can be disclosed. It's classified. It will help the enemy. We're hearing that now from Secretary of State Kerry, and it's being brought into the open now. I mean, the fact that this information is not being given, in particular, the representative in Congress from Florida, Alan Grayson, has been putting some information out on his website. He's been in a participant in some of the so-called classified briefings that have been held for members of Congress, and says that even in those briefings, the information is a bit sketchy. And of course, those members of Congress are sworn to secrecy on what they're told. but the information often turns out, you know, not to be accurate. I mean, we had a situation in 1998 in Sudan where we bombed a pharmaceutical factory and said that a precursor element of a substance generally referred to as nerve gas called VX, that it was being produced there and it was going to be given to Al-Qaeda to use against the United States. And it turned out after the fact that there probably never was such a thing being produced in that factory. Yet we went ahead and bombed and, you know, killed some people in the neighborhood. We destroyed the a factory that was producing all the pharmaceutical products that, for the country of Sudan. Finally, when the New York Times followed up on it and got some administration officials to admit, although not for the record, but to admit that there was really no evidence that any such thing was being produced at the factory.
You know what's interesting about that? So here in Oregon, you know what? Oregon and Washington, we've just had this inexplicable stream of terrorism convictions, right? Oregon and Washington, these are not the metropolitan areas of the United States, right? And I guess that people could argue there's a reason for that. The 9/11 bombers, they got onto the planes in some podunk part of Florida or whatever. That's where they hung out. So maybe the feds are just keeping their eyes on more rural areas. But we've had really an inexplicable amount of these terrorism convictions in the Pacific Northwest, and they're all of Muslim people, right? And so last week, the most fascinating thing happened. There was a man named Pete Seda. Pete Seda, a Muslim gentleman who lived in Ashland, Oregon, a beloved member of his community there. He did all kinds of community work, and I'm talking about before 9/11. So he hooked up with this nonprofit called Al Haramain. Right. And he pumped a bunch of money into Al Haramain, and it was for all sorts of things, you know, different community things. And then the U.S. government came out and basically said, nope, Al Haramain at some point gave money to somebody that's on our bad list. So now that means everything they do is considered to be terroristic. And so Pete Seda was actually prosecuted, right, for aiding and abetting terrorists, even though this man, he's never hurt anyone ever. It's a fascinating case. But what's really interesting is, and this has happened a number of times in Oregon, he was basically in the end convicted of some kind of tax evasion thing. Just like a really beloved sheikh here about 10 years ago, he was going through the Portland International Airport and the TSA screener, it wasn't TSA at the time, they had a different name, I forgot what it was, they said that there was gunpowder residue or something in the guy's bag. And he was arrested, but he, in the end, was convicted of filling out a food stamp application incorrectly. So here in Oregon, basically the last week of August, the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals overturned Pete Seda's conviction for tax fraud, which, according to the government, had links to terrorism. Basically, the appeals court basically said he was prosecuted for terrorism but only convicted of tax fraud. And part of why is because the prosecutors did not turn over all the information to the defense. It's fascinating. It's kind of on a microcosm exactly what you just described, John Quigley. Do you understand what I'm saying? We're going after these people and saying terrorism, 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 but they can't be convicted of that in court because probably they didn't do that. So they're getting convicted of what? Tax fraud or filling out a food stamp application incorrectly. But it makes me curious about how embattled our Muslim communities are in the state. I mean, do either of you, Mr. Quigley or Mr. Bonpain, do you ever work with Muslim communities? Do you have any connections there to look at what they're dealing with behind, you know, this is kind of what our new war machine does, really, in our local communities, singling out Muslim people. But do either of you care to comment on that?
Well, we have in Los Angeles the Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, which includes the Muslim community. And it's a very effective group which simply states that religion must not bless war. And they're very much aware, as Mr. Quigley has pointed out so beautifully, that wars are started by contrivances and also by creating scapegoats. And we've certainly scapegoated the Muslim community. It actually is reminiscent of the hatred of Jews that was developed during the Third Reich. It was the same kind of thing. These are bad people. We have to kill these people. It is absolute hysteria, and it is a great way to start wars, another contrivance. And what happens in the midst of this, and what Mr. Obama is very worried about, is a loss of credibility. Well, ask any classroom full of students, do you believe the NSA is credible? Do you believe the CIA is credible? Do you believe what's coming forth from the administration is credible? And you're going to get a negative answer. Mm-hmm. And that is tragic, that the very institutions of government are not trusted. There have been too many lies, too many contrivances, too much demonizing of wonderful people. And that is what wars are made of. And then there's also the element of using religion as a cloak for malice. Sunnis and Shias were always intermarrying. There was no issue. But now they're killing each other because their systems have been used to divide them. The same happened with Protestants and Catholics for literally hundreds of years, killing each other over something they knew nothing about, which was dogma. They don't know anything about it. They love to argue about it. And good government, and you might say good spirituality, is not concerned about dogmatics. It's concerned about conduct, conduct that is humane, conduct that reflects the fruits of the Spirit, which are peace and justice and joy and love and endurance and courage. Those are the things that have to be stressed, not some dogmas that no one understands, that we can argue for hundreds of years whether Sunni or Shia is correct, whether Protestant or Catholic is correct. It is a waste of time. And the same is happening with Islam and Buddhism. Religion is a great game to play by politicians that couldn't care less about it but want to use it to say, God is on our side. Mm. Well, God help them.
Mr. Bompain, your autobiography looks fabulous, and I've not read it. It came out in 2011, and it's called Imagine No Religion. Why'd you choose that title? What is that book about?
Well, it's about the dangers of religiosity. It's about making a religion out of your country. It's about American exceptionalism, which is a religion. It's about saying that I, as every fundamentalist does, I have the truth, and you are a devil, and I'm called to kill the devil. Mr. Toynbee, the great historian, said when we become an absolutist, when we become basically a fundamentalist, we will kill because we have the truth and the only truth. And we must either stomp out the devil or we will lose the war against evil. So that's the type of religion I'm opposing. And I'm also trying to say that the name of your religion tells us nothing about you. Augusto Pinochet Ugarte was always anxious to go to Holy Communion. Well, that's very nice, as he killed people by the thousands. The same was true of the great Rios Montt in Guatemala. He was preaching every Sunday as he destroyed Mayan villages all through the week. Religion can be used for what? A crusade? A ridiculous concept? That there's such a thing as a just war, which has been part of imperial religion, that gave us the Crusades and the Inquisition, that we are right and error has no rights whatsoever. Because you are a Protestant or a Jew, we can kill you unless you repent. This type of use of religion is still probably worse than ever historically. So what I'm trying to do is get people to identify with the things that matter, peace and justice. Those are the issues. Those are the issues of real spirituality and not some kind of a fraud religion.
Peace and justice.
And that's why, after being in religion so long, I thought, gee, it would be great if people could put their religiosity aside, the word itself is important. The word comes from the Latin religo, which is really the word for relegate. It means to bind and to cast aside. So you bind people to a certain doctrine. You tell them they have to believe that or they'll go to hell. And then you cast them aside into your club, and they're to remain there. Well, that is very, very dangerous. I don't think God has a religion, and I certainly am not promoting atheism or agnosticism. I'm very much a theist, but we can't make God into some tiny little thing, some tiny little group of people that has all the truth. And I think that the misuse of religion is at the heart of the wars that we have today. And we in the United States, our country represents Jesus, you know, and people that believe that will support bombing Syria.
You know what is amazing to me about this, too, is we've seen a number of stories playing out over the past several years where, I mean, what strikes me is that sort of these, I don't know what's the right word that I want to use, really, really precision language here, these sort of stereotypes of conservative religiosity, what you're talking about, the religiosity thing, it's so parallel to what we're told the Taliban believes. It's like when I look at sort of the conservative Christian right in this country, it's a mirror image of what I think is the Taliban, what I've always been told reading the newspaper, what the Taliban is. And yeah. We've seen these, it's not funny, but it's almost clownish. A few years ago when the preacher I feel as though he was in Texas, but it may have been somewhere else, he burned a Quran, and so there were riots, and I feel as though they were in Pakistan. Sometimes I think that these conservative fundamentalists on different parts of the world need each other. They feed off each other. And whether it's here or there, they use that, like you said, as a tool to, mobilize their base, consolidate their power in their own region.
We're victims of nationalistic fundamentalism. But fundamentalisms are really very, very similar. I when I hear about the Taliban or any of the fundamentalist groups, I think about Christian fundamentalists. I think about people who would say that we have to destroy Palestine in order to have the Battle of Armageddon come about. They have no idea what they are talking about. They're making it up as they go along and trying to revive a 19th century ideology of millennialism. And people somehow want to believe, and they tie that in with their false patriotism, and you have the disaster that our founders spoke about, which is patriotism as the last refuge of scoundrels.
Mm-hmm. We're live on the phone with Blaise Bonpain of the Office of the Americas and international law expert John Quigley from the Ohio State University. John, I want to ask you a really complicated question about this, okay? So we've been watching the trial of Nidal Hassan, the guy that was in the military, and he started shooting people at Fort Hood, and he's when we look at some of these terrorism and terror-related trials, we see this confluence, it's more like a train wreck of religion and law. And what I'm reading about always with Nidal Hassan is that he wants the death sentence. Something, you know, I'm just going to say straight up, I don't want to believe everything I read in the newspaper anymore, and I work in a newspaper, okay? But what they're saying is that Nidal Hassan wants the death sentence because that's what's going to take him to paradise, okay? And when you see that hit the headlines and you see that on the news, it's such an emotional aspect of the exceptionalism that Mr. Bonpain is talking about. But Mr. Quigley, can you talk a little bit about, like, with these terrorism things, and as we were talking about demonization of the Muslim community, how what happens when those things land in court?
Well, I think these things don't really get elaborated and resolved in court, as we see in the case you're mentioning from Texas. We have this analysis of his motivation, which may or may not be true. But I think in many situations, you've found in general that some Muslims are resorting to what they perceive as their correct interpretation of Islam as a way of countering the hegemony of the United States in the region. So I think in effect you have political points being made in religious terms, which doesn't mean that they're anything necessarily about their theology, but it seems to me that we're putting much too much emphasis on religion as a source of such things as that fellow's action in Texas, when it really relates to something else, but is being voiced in religious terms.
I was last year. I got to go to the local FBI media field training day, and it was an eye opener and no mistake about that. And I was asking, to be fair, this totally wonderful guy with the FBI who was giving a lecture about how they do what they do. And point of information, our local FBI, the Oregon FBI, they say that their focus is going for child pornographers. And we see that. I see that in the press releases that I see coming from the FBI every day. And I think that is something that they should be looking at. The question that I had for the man that was making the presentation was, okay, the shooter in the movie theater, right, that took out all those people, how do you define what is a terrorist event? Okay. And the FBI guy said, that's not a terrorist event. And I said, he said, a terrorist event is if you can show that you have some sort of motivation that propels you down a road towards committing a violent act. So I said, okay, what if the shooter in that movie theater was Muslim? And he said, okay, you win. And he gave me a little beer glass with the FBI logo on it. And he didn't really talk about that. But it is interesting. It's like, again, I'm stuck on this weird place where the courts, right, and the religion crash together. And the only reason that some, I don't want to oversimplify it, I'm wondering in how many cases are people charged with terrorism just because of their religious beliefs. I want to jump over here today, right now, though, and say, coming up on KBOO at 9 on Political Perspectives, host Per Fogrein interviews professor and activist Rania Mansouri about Syria, Beyond the Falsehoods and False Choices, a Reaction to Obama's Speech. The phone lines will be open for your calls, listeners. At 10, it's Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features more analysis of the situation in Syria with an extended interview with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. That's going to be good. At 11 on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen welcomes John Salvett to talk about his food forest and growing unusual fruits and his grafting experiments and quince. He knows quince. Quince is a fascinating fruit. You can't just eat it. You have to cook it, but it's really magical. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio. We're coming to the top of our hour here. We are with liberation theology champion Blaise Bond Payne of the Office of the Americas and international law expert John Quigley from Ohio State University. And, you know, Mr. Quigley, Mr. Bond Payne, I'm going to start moving us towards the end of the show. We've got about 7 minutes. And I want to ask you, did either of you listen to the president's speech last night? And what did you think about it?
Well, I thought that he was very flummoxed by the things that he had said. And he focused on the poison gas issue, which is only a part of the terrible slaughter that has gone on.
100,000 people dead, and I thought a lot of people died in Guatemala. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, people often say that this is all Assad. Well, maybe Assad is responsible for half of the 100,000. Which side are we on? We're on neither side. The idea that you have to side in wars as if it's a football game is absolutely obnoxious. We are not on either side. We are on the side of peace, and we know that invasions create civil war instantly. Mm-hmm. Once an invasion goes on, certain people in the invaded country identify with the invader because they can get jobs or whatever and feed their families. Others in the same country consider them traitors, and you have the beginning of a civil war. That's what invasion does, and that's what our invasions have done. We're seeing Iraq today fully at war because of our invasion. So we have an awful lot to learn, And we have to learn how to be peacemakers. Rather than war makers.
And on that, if anybody's listening right now, I have to recommend a book. It's called War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning by Christopher Hedges. If you go to the KBOO website, you can search around and find interviews with him about that book. It's a very short book. It's a very small book, and it's going to rock your world, and that's exactly what it's about. And Mr. Quigley, I want to ask you, did you have a chance to listen to the president last night, and what did you think?
Yes. It's very odd now that he's sort of backing off and is asking the Congress to delay adopting anything. In terms of avoiding military conflict, I think it's certainly a good thing that this idea has come up to deal with chemical weaponry in another way. I think it's going to make it ultimately rather difficult for the president to come back if he finds what Syria is doing not to be sufficient, because it's clear that Congress is not happy with going along with a military action. So it seems to me that what has happened does hold the prospect of putting the possibility of military force into the background.
All right. And we have a caller. Let's take that caller quick as we can. We have Ed on the phone. Ed, what are you thinking this morning?
Oh, well, thanks for taking my call. I'm encouraged that we're able to talk about the overthrow of Allende and also Mossadegh. It seems like every time we wanted to talk about Iran, we always began with the hostage taking. But I think it's very important to expose the truth about these situations, and I wonder if your guests have any insight into how long it will be before we're able to openly discuss the facts behind the September 11 attack. And
Sweet, Ed. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ed. Thanks for calling. You guys, let's make this the last comment. When are we ever going to get to the bottom of 9/11? When, you know, and I didn't frame this show as being about 9/11 because it's so complicated and people are so passionate about it. But Mr. Quigley, Mr. Bompain, when do you think we're ever going to find out what really happened?
Well, we'll find out. It may take some years, but some of the glaring things that have not been dealt with are how Building 7 came down. There is no acceptable explanation of that. So we'd like to know what happened there. It appears there were some explosives in the building, but we still know that something very strange took place, and we hope to get to understand it. We're still discussing who killed John Kennedy, you know, which is so tragic to be discussing things so long after an event and really not have a handle on it. And I don't think we have a handle on what happened on September 11th.
What do you think, Mr. Quigley?
Yeah, well, it often takes a generation to get to the bottom of these things, because that's when governments typically begin to declassify documents from a period. And that often gives you some insight. I mean, not entirely. They don't declassify everything. So it may be a very long time, I think.
Yeah. I just have to, you know what, we're going to have to leave it there. It was such an incredible privilege to talk with you both. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, John Quigley. Wonderful to hear from you. And thank you, Lisa.
Thank you. That's it for our show. Thanks to our guest, Blaise Bompain. He's got a website, officeoftheamericas.wordpress.com, and also John Quigley. Special thanks to engineer Steve Nasser and Sky the Studio Dog. This show will be podcast on KBOO.fm by the end of the day. Grab that link and share it with your friends and family. I'm Lisa Loving. Follow me on Twitter for more news and information about the topics we discuss on this show. Theme music by the March 4th Marching Band. 6 p.m. tonight on the Hawthorne Bridge. Bring your candles and signs. Stay tuned for Political Perspectives.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 104.3 FM Philomath and Corvallis. The time is 9 o'clock straight up. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, your host, Per Foggering, interviews professor and activist Rania Masri about Syria, beyond the falsehoods and false choices, a reaction to Obama's speech. The phone lines will be open for your calls. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints features more analysis of the situation in Syria with an extended interview with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. And at 11 on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen welcomes John Salvit to talk about his food forest and growing unusual fruits and his grafting experiments. And Quince. He knows Quince.
Wednesdays in Portland are a little more festive these days, thanks to Creative Collaborations and Hump Day PDX. Hump Day PDX is a street festival in Southeast Portland, featuring the live music and art exhibits of creative entrepreneurs who are living on the streets. There are also family activities to enjoy, food to eat, and a beer garden for drink, all organized by Creative Collaborations in support of struggling artists and in an effort to stimulate the local neighborhood economy. The next Hump Day PDX is September 11th from 7 to 10 p.m. at Southeast 9th and Belmont in Portland. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage.